The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Here's your money briefing for Friday, April 30th. I'm J.R. Whalen for The Wall Street Journal. Today, we close out our week-long investment guide with a look at an asset that's taken the investing world by storm, Bitcoin. Its meteoric rise in value has brought a new generation of investors into the market, hoping to get a piece of the action. But the wild price swings in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are not for the faint of heart.
Where they belong is sort of on the bleeding edge of your risk tolerance. You could get the greatest returns on the planet from investing these things, you could get wiped out. How much money are you willing to risk on a really, really big bet?
So how do cryptocurrencies work, and what role could they play in a portfolio? We'll get a quick class in Bitcoin 101 with our cryptocurrency reporter, Paul Vigna, after the break.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
When Bitcoin came on the scene, it generated a lot of buzz. It was a bit mysterious, very techy, and promising to revolutionize how we think about currency. Now, a few years down the line, it's still buzzy, still techy, but it hasn't replaced cash or credit cards, and it's also become known as a highly speculative asset. It can be hot one day and cold the next. So is it a good investment? Paul Vigna has been covering the cryptocurrency markets for the Wall Street Journal for years. He's even written books about it. Paul, thanks for being with us.
JR, happy to be here.
All right, so Paul, if there's one thing people know about Bitcoin, it's that the price has absolutely skyrocketed over the past couple of years. When we're recording this, it's down a bit from its peak, but still over $50,000. And if there's a second thing people know about Bitcoin, it's probably that its price can fall just as fast. What is it that causes Bitcoin to go up or down?
In Bitcoin's history, it has had a couple of very well-defined cycles where the price has gone up quite a lot, and then the cycle has come down quite a lot. And every one of those cycles has brought in new people. And people get in on the upside, you know, when the price is going up, and they think, oh my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. This thing goes up like mad. It can't go down. I can't lose. And then it goes down. And I think what people need to keep in mind is that Bitcoin is almost completely, it really, to a large, large degree, it is driven by momentum and sentiment and speculation. People are buying Bitcoin because they think the price is going to go up. Some people buy Bitcoin because they believe it's going to be the future and they're going to hold it forever because they think the price is going to go up and they can sell it later for a lot more money. So in most cases, what you are buying is this sentiment that the price is going to go up. That creates, it tends to create its own momentum, and you get these long, long rallies where the price goes up. But, you know, look, Bitcoin's not a stock. It's not a company. It doesn't have cash flows. It doesn't have earning statements. It's not a bond that pays interest on its own. You are basically buying it because of what people think about it. So it is completely sentiment driven. That becomes a momentum driven market. And that is what drives the price.
Okay, you just mentioned some things that Bitcoin is not. So I want to ask you what it is. How is a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin different from a traditional currency?
Bitcoin is a form of private money. It is similar to the money that we all grew up with and that we're used to, in that you can use it as a medium of exchange. You can use it to buy and sell things. You can use it for trading. You can use it as a place to sort of park your wealth as a so-called store of value. There are two main differences. The first main difference is that this is not government-backed money. That's very simply what it is. What we are used to is money that is backed by the government. It's printed by the government. It is supported by the government. It is maintained by the government. This is, it's beyond private money. It's basically a software project is what this really is. And that's kind of the second difference, is that Bitcoin is not physical money. Bitcoin basically exists on a network that is a piece of software that runs on a connected network of computers. That's what it is, the Bitcoin network, the Bitcoin protocol. So you have this computerized network that runs 24/7 that is used for maintaining and transacting in this digital money called Bitcoin.
So the iconic image of Bitcoin we often see is a gold-colored coin with a B on it, standing for Bitcoin, of course. But if somebody invests in Bitcoin, you don't actually physically own a bunch of those coins, right?
You do not. And to an extent, our industry, the media industry, is kind of guilty of helping to perpetuate this, because a lot of times when we're writing stories, we're looking for some way to illustrate the story. So invariably, what we end up doing is we use an image of those coins. But those coins are not units of currency. They're really just novelty coins. Somebody printed them up and just to kind of have that physical feel, that tactile feel. But they're not real units of currency. They don't represent actual Bitcoins. There are some, I will point out, again, this is how complicated it gets. People have created some that have a chip embedded in them, and they do actually have some Bitcoin embedded in them, but those aren't widely circulated or used. The ones that you see basically are just little novelty coins. They're not real.
So you mentioned earlier that Bitcoin could be used to buy things, and that's different from a lot of investments. You know, you can't buy groceries with a share of Procter & Gamble. So what does that sort of dual use of Bitcoin mean for investors?
This is part of the evolving nature of Bitcoin. And I said that with a certain lilt in my voice because it sounds silly, and it is a little silly. But the reality is Bitcoin was invented to be electronic cash. That was the phrasing used in the initial white paper describing it. It was supposed to be a digital version, an online version that you could use on the internet, of physical cash. It hasn't quite worked out that way. A lot of people now buy Bitcoin for reasons that have nothing to do with wanting to spend it. They're buying it because they think it's going to be an inflation hedge. They're buying it because they think the U.S. currency is being debased, so I want to have something to protect against, you know, the ultimate collapse of the global financial system. They're buying it because they think it's a digital version of gold. So that crowd, that buy and hold crowd, that works against Bitcoin's buy and use to buy things crowd. If you're buying Bitcoin and the price is going up, are you going to want to use that to spend on something you want to buy on Amazon? Or are you going to think, oh, I should hold it, you know, because the price is going to go up. I'm not going to go buy a book with it because that book is going to lose me money in the long run. So Bitcoin has some use as a payments currency, Some people do use it for that, but it hasn't really evolved that's become a major use case of it. So it'll be interesting to see if people do want to do that. If you bought a year ago, you've made a lot of money. So you might be looking at Bitcoin, your Bitcoin holdings is like, I got fat on my Bitcoin holdings. I've got money that I just did not have a year ago. I'm going to go buy something. And some people are definitely doing that. So there are people using it to buy things, but there's a friction between people using it to buy things and people using it just to hold. And it's not clear which way that's going to go yet. In fact, I would say right now it is leaning more towards the hold crowd.
Now, Paul, Bitcoin isn't the only kind of cryptocurrency out there, right? Yeah. I mean, what can you tell us about these other options?
So when Bitcoin was released out into the wild, so to speak, it was released as an open software project, meaning anybody could take that software, download it on their own, tweak the code, do whatever they wanted to it, and create their own version of Bitcoin. So in the years since Bitcoin launched, there have been all kinds of imitators. There are thousands of Bitcoin-like tokens out there. They call them altcoins, alternative Bitcoins. So there are thousands of altcoins out there. The vast majority of them are very thin. Almost no one's using them, or they have very small communities around them. They're not proven. There's really only a handful at the top that in the years since they've been released that have a large-scale following.
Yeah, and the one we seem to hear the most about is called Ethereum. How does that work?
Ethereum has emerged as the sort of the number two crypto. What it is a version of Bitcoin where the underlying features were taken, but they were repurposed for something else. So what does that mean? Bitcoin was built for currency. It was built as a platform for two people to exchange value. That's what it does. That's what it does best. That's what it was built for. Ethereum was built to be a platform for other people to build apps on top of it. It's sort of like a decentralized Android. It is a platform for apps, and they call them decentralized apps or dApps. You'll hear that. So Ethereum took the principles behind Bitcoin and just built a platform with a different use in mind. Rather than payments, it is apps. It's a platform to support apps.
There's also been a lot of talk lately about Dogecoin. What exactly is that? And what do investors need to know about it?
Dogecoin is a joke. And I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean that literally. Two guys created it in 2013. They basically took the Bitcoin code and just put this funny meme on top of it as a name. This Doge, which is a picture of this Shiba Inu dog that has been pulled off the internet. It was a meme on the internet. Fast forward, you know, 7-8 years later, and Dogecoin, because everything is so hot right now and everything is a winning bet right now and the markets are so flooded with liquidity, and because you now have this sort of entire world of memes, and you have these Reddit crowds that are just looking to sort of, you know, jump on anything, somebody says, hey, let's start buying Dogecoin and push the price up. That's it. This goofy joke cryptocurrency, some people on some message boards just on a lark said, let's drive the price of this thing up, and it takes off. If you want to have some fun with your money, yeah, go ahead, put it into Dogecoin. If you want to invest with your money, you're not investing in Dogecoin. You're just playing around.
Okay, so some people might see cryptocurrencies as a joke, but people do trade currencies. It's called Forex, short for foreign exchange. So is there any legitimacy to cryptocurrency as an investment? And what role could it play in somebody's portfolio?
This is what I think people are trying to figure out. People who are real investors, not, you know, Dogecoin fanatics on a message board, but people who are real investors are trying to figure out, where do these things fit? These things are not really, they don't trade like national currencies do. The ranges are, except for the most, you know, I don't know, collapsing foreign currency, the ranges that these things trade in are much, much wider than the dollar, the euro, the yen, the pound, any of that. They don't trade like foreign currencies. So if your question is, where do they belong in a portfolio, they don't belong alongside your Forex holdings. Where they belong is sort of on the bleeding edge of your risk tolerance. You could get the greatest returns on the planet from investing these things. You could get wiped out. How much money are you willing to risk on a really, really big bet? That, whatever that number is, whatever that percentage is, that's where these things belong within your portfolio.
Okay, so last question. For somebody who wants to take on the risk and get into Bitcoin or another cryptocurrency, how do they actually go about it?
You would go to one of the big exchanges. In the United States, that's Coinbase, that's Gemini, Kraken. You would go to the exchange, open up an account. They're going to ask you for some ID, from information. You're going to link your bank account to it, and then you would fund that account. You'd put some money into it, and they buy Bitcoin on your behalf. And then you have a Bitcoin wallet, and you have an account, and you can buy and sell on their exchanges, on their platforms.
All right, that's Wall Street Journal cryptocurrency reporter Paul Vigna. Paul, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, JR.
And that wraps up Investment Week. You can find more information about building an investment portfolio and various kinds of assets you might put your money into in the personal finance section of the journal website at wsj.com. I'm J.R. Whalen for the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.